Bala Lita Di. Good evening, good afternoon, and welcome once again to our class, Kundalini, the Inner Goddess, and the Process of Transformation. Today we're going to begin our conversation about chakras, and much of the class will be a prolonged meditation on chakras, on our own experience. And what I want to say before we start is really to answer some questions that came up on the listserv about meditations that start to happen spontaneously, in which we start out following the instructions that I'm giving, but which eventually take their own shape so that there's a kind of natural draw, a natural pull inward, in which the breath may not want to behave the way I'm suggesting that it behaves, but will have its own spontaneous movement or stillness, in which there will be a sense of pulsation or vibration in the body. And what I want to suggest is that if you're having that sort of spontaneous meditation opening, that you just consider that to be your meditation. And then when the mind becomes active again, come back to the instructions. Really, the purpose of these instructions is actually threefold. One is to give you a frame for becoming present to Kundalini moving in your body, and in the case of this particular class, of Kundalini in the different chakras. Another purpose of these instructions is actually to give you a kind of prompt that will open you into the meditation current, which many of you are familiar with and which some of you have mentioned on the listserv, which is that spontaneous bandwidth where your innate meditation state begins to emerge. And that experience of moving into the spontaneous meditation current always trumps instructions. If there's one thing I'd love you to take away from these classes, and indeed all of my classes, is to trust what is arising as the meditation current starts to emerge. And the third object of these instructions is simply to give you a focal point for the mind, to give you a way of concentration that can take your mind inward. And specifically, in the case of these practices, take your mind into the Sushumna Nadi, into the chakras. So last week, we spoke about some of the ways in which Kundalini is awakened. We spoke about Shaktipat, that mysterious descent of energy that really comes from the heart of reality into our bodies and minds. We talked about, actually we've been speaking about it in both the previous classes, one of the most mysterious and beautiful contemplation sutras on awakening, which comes from the sage Aurobindo, who says that in order for the revolution of consciousness to occur, there must be an arousal from above and a calling or arising from below, meaning from within us. And of course, that is what we're working with during this process. We're actually tuning in to the descent of Shakti, the arousal from above, the spontaneous desire of the universal Shakti, Kundalini, to awaken us. And this week, we're going to speak about some of the experiences that occur as Shakti works within us. And again, beginning the conversation about chakras. So we will continue with the mantra that invokes Kundalini Shakti. It's the Kundalini Dhyanam mantra. It is on the handout on the homepage. But again, I'll give you the translation. The English says, "Let us contemplate the upward flowing goddess Kundalini, who is nectar, who is subtle, who is the embodiment of the power of manifestation, that is, who is the creator, sustainer, and absorber of the universe, who also transcends the universe, who is one with the absolute, who is wisdom itself." So let's chant together. Dhyayet kundalinim devim Swayambhu Linga Veshtinim Shyamam Sukshmam Shristi Rupam Shristi Stiti Layatmakam Vyatitam Jnana Rupam Chintayet Urdhva Vahinim Dhyayet Kundalinim Devim Swayambhu Linga Veshtinim. And as you become aware of the power that moves your breath, which is indeed the power of Kundalini, allowing her in this moment to guide the breath, allowing yourself to begin to feel how you are in fact being breathed by the prana shakti of the universe. I also want to offer you a prayer that you'll be receiving in written form in the homework. It's a prayer that Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, whom we spoke about last week, the great devotee of the goddess, who was also perhaps the sage most responsible for bringing the Eastern tradition that we know today as Vedanta to the West. He was a great lover of the goddess in the form of Kali, and he used to pray to her to be taken beyond all dualities, all judgments, all ideas that create separation in order to realize the pure love that is really the essence of Kundalini, that is the essence of Shakti, who is the Divine Mother. She is love itself, no matter what form she is taking in our lives at a given moment. Her motivation, the goal of her movement, and her essence is love. So here are the words, and you can just allow these words to resonate in whatever way they resonate for you. It's very good when we're reading a devotional poem, and this is definitely that, to bring your awareness into the heart. Perhaps place your hand, your palm over the center of your chest to begin to activate the Ananda Kanda, the spiritual heart, in the center of the chest, just a little to the right of the physical heart. So here's what he says. O Mother, take your sin and take your virtue and give me only pure love for you. Take your goodness and take your evil and give me only pure love for you. Take your intelligence and take your dullness. Give me only pure love for you. Take your success and take your failure. Give me only pure love for you. Take your gifts and take your losses and give me only pure love for you. And as you contemplate the meaning behind Ramakrishna's words, you might consider what dualities in your life this prayer can begin to activate. You know, for some of us, it's beauty and ugliness, or youth and age, or love and anger, or riches and poverty. There are so many dualities that we live in. And what Ramakrishna, of course, is speaking to in a very personal way is the truth that Shakti, whom he addresses very personally as Goddess Kali, is constantly becoming everything in our experience. So success is her and failure is her. Virtue is her and sin is her. For some reason, those ideas, good is her and evil is her, those are hard for us. But Ramakrishna had realized this fact that all of it is goddess. And of course, this never stopped him from choosing good, from turning to virtue. But nonetheless, it allowed him to understand the absolute non-duality that is the heart of the tradition of Shakti. So when he says to Kali, please give me only pure love for you, he's asking to experience love as goddess and to be able to see goddess, to be able to see Shakti as the wholeness of experience, as everything that exists, he is saying, belongs to you. I offer every part of my experience back to you, everything that feels good and everything that doesn't feel good. And in truth, what he's asking and what Kundalini is wishing to do for us, with us, is to remove our feelings of duality, our feelings of opposition, so that whatever arises in our lives can actually be experienced as a part of her, as a part of the One, and as a part of ourselves. This weekend I was at an event in which we were doing a women's circle. I was a participant, not a leader. And at the end of the event, it was a somewhat contentious circle. And at the end of the event, someone who had been sort of quiet said, you know, I didn't feel like speaking very much, but I was having the experience, which is, she told us, something that she's been practicing in her Gestalt group. I was having the experience that everything that everyone said was an aspect of myself, and that when someone said something that I didn't like, I would remind myself and I would experience that there was this was referring to a part of myself that I don't accept. So really the effect of Kundalini's rise within us, and it takes place for some of us rather early in the process, but for all of us, it will take place eventually, is the recognition that this entire field of our experience is a mandala reflecting what's going on within us. And though that understanding has become kind of a new age cliche in certain ways, so that sometimes we feel that, oh, this is just something we say to make ourselves feel better about stuff that actually sucks. What Kundalini shows us is that it's really true, and that as she transforms our awareness and as our inner work allows us to see, to witness, and to allow her to dissolve the obstructive qualities, at that point we really do begin to see, and it's a kind of miracle, what it really means to say that the world we experience outside is actually happening inside, as someone shared with us on the website a video from British TV about how the brain works, how the brain literally creates our experience of separation, of color, of form, out of what is actually a kind of energy soup. And fully risen Kundalini shows us what this really means, shows us the dance. So this awareness, this recognition as an actual experience rather than as the intellectual understanding that comes from having studied brain science, doesn't happen without an act of grace, without the Kundalini's gift of possibility. And there will be times, and I know that's true for many of you, in meditation or in open-eyed moments, when we're really able to experience the paradox of Kundalini, that she can arouse affection in us, even when it doesn't seem as though there is anything to feel affectionate about. And we're going to settle now into the fundamental rhythm of the rising and falling breath. And we're going to do it with two core attitudes, which I've come to believe are the core attitudes for real spiritual unfoldment. They're described in different ways. I recently read in a Christian contemplative text which described them as cordiality and attention. essentially what you know, these words mean are softness, welcoming, and awareness. So our awareness and our willingness to welcome what is are really the keys to allowing the spiritual growth process, which is the true meaning of Kundalini awakening, to occur naturally. So bringing our attention, our awareness to the flow of the subtle prana, the prana shakti within the breath, the breath within the breath. Prana kundalini, kundalini pulsing within the natural flow, the rhythm of our breath. The prana shakti pulses constantly in a spiral pattern. Physically, it expresses itself through the spiraling movement of the cerebrospinal fluid. Subtly, we're experiencing it as the sensations of energy moving in our inner body, moving through the central channel, moving in the centers that we've come to call the chakras, moving as the current of energy that we feel flowing in meditation. And it's said that as this inner energy subtly unfolds, as it unfolds in the central channel, in the Sushumna Nadi, it creates in us the re-experience, the recognition, the recognition of ourselves as Chidananda, the bliss of consciousness. So whether or not we experience ourselves at this moment as blissful, we can bring our awareness into the flow of the breath. And if you're sitting, you can let the inhalation, we're going to start inhaling down and exhaling up, and then we'll shift into the particular meditative breath concentration that we've been working with. So in this moment, feel that the inhalation draws your awareness down to the base. You feel as you inhale down towards the base of the posture that the breath allows your hips and thighs and sits bones to sink, to become heavy, to take the support of the seat. And with the exhalation, you feel the breath flowing up your spinal column, vertebra by vertebra, if you're able to focus that intensely, or just feeling the breath flowing up the center of the spine, drawing your body upwards, up through the crown. Inhale and feel the chest lift and open. Exhale and see if you can allow the shoulder blades to release down the back. For just a moment, let yourself experience the physical inhalation as that movement in the lungs and diaphragm by which the lungs expand to the sides. And in the exhalation, feel the rib cage contracting back. Just see if you can allow the lungs to fill front, sides, and back, but especially moving the sides of your rib cage outwards. Feeling perhaps what a gift it is to be able to take a full breath in this way. And now begin to be aware of the central channel, this corridor of energy that runs from the perineum and below the perineum, up through the crown and above the crown. feel that with the inhalation, your awareness moves up the body from the base to the crown and above the crown. And then with the exhalation, feel or imagine or sense that the awakening, enlivening energy of the cosmic Shakti is flowing down your body through the crown, down through the center of the head, the neck, the torso, and down to the very base of the body, to the perineum, and then below, to the earth center below the body. And with the next inhalation, you can add the mantra, Om Aim Hrim Shrim, as the breath flows upward. And then allow the breath, the exhalation, to sweep down your body with Om Aim Hrim Shrim. As thoughts arise, just notice the thought as thinking. Let your attention, your awareness, come back to the flow of the breath. Remember, breath is Shakti. Awareness or attention is Shiva. So in this act of attending to the breath with the mantra, which is a great Shakti mantra, we are actually uniting the subtle masculine with the subtle feminine inside our bodies. The breath flowing upwards with the inhalation and Om Aim Rim Shrim, flowing back down with the exhalation and Om Aim Rim Shrim. And I invite you to open your eyes, but I also invite you to keep them closed if that feels better for you. I know that for some of you, go into a kind of interiorized state at the beginning of one of these calls, and if that's what's happening, just let yourself be there. A lot of this class, as I told you, is going to be contemplative, meditative. So I want to tell you a story which is one of the great classical symbolic stories from the Puranas, the Indian mythological books, about the work of transformation that occurs as Kundalini is activated. It's the story of the churning of the ocean of milk. And like all the really great classical stories, this myth can be invoked in the service of many different kinds of transformation. So what is the ocean of milk? It's actually the ocean of awareness, the vast, endless subtlety, the suchness within which all things arise and subside. The ocean of milk is, we could say, the great mind heart. And since this mythic story is from a culture that, instead of demonizing dairy, as some of us do today, considered cows holy and milk to be the purest form of nourishing substance. In fact, milk was really the favorite analogy, one of the favorite analogies for the nourishing quality of consciousness. So it was natural that it should, that in the symbology of the vast ocean, it would be called an ocean of milk. Because, as you know, the physical ocean is salty, you can't really drink it, but the ocean of consciousness is nourishment itself. It's really the creative heart of everything. So here's the story. Way back before the beginning of human time, the soma, a special substance that confers immortality, had been lost by the gods due to a series of mistakes. And the soma in the Indian scriptures, in the Hindu scriptures, is sometimes called amrita, which means nectar. And scholars have puzzled over the centuries about what the soma really was. Some scholars equate it with intoxicating substances like the psilocybin mushroom. And the name soma was actually given to certain distilled intoxicants used by yogis to induce hallucinations. So the scholars aren't wrong about that. However, the deeper meaning of soma, and certainly the soma in this story, represents what I call the liquid light, the fluid illumination that flows from the highest spiritual centers into the body and which is unleashed in deep meditation, especially as Kundalini rises to the topmost chakras. And when the soma is released and starts to pour through our bodies. In some of the poetic texts about Kundalini, this is called overturning the pot of nectar. And in some of the mystical texts, it's said that when the soma, the pot of amrita, the pot of nectar, overturns in the crown, it sends through the body a rejuvenating fluid that literally transforms the body. One of the great poet saints of this non-dual tradition speaks of how when this soma, when this fluid flows through the body, it actually makes your teeth fall out and new little teeth come in, you know, new pearly, completely rejuvenated teeth. It rejuvenates your skin. It rejuvenates your organs. And it is, in fact, the famous philosopher's stone that the alchemists, the old alchemists, tried to create through their different processes, and which is one of the holy grail. It's, you know, one of the holy grails of Ayurveda is getting access to this rejuvenating quality inside the body. So for the practitioner, I'll leave aside the question of whether there is actual physical rejuvenation as Kundalini opens the Sahasrara. What there certainly is the profound flow of bliss, love, and the feeling of kind of global well-being. And so we can assume that when the gods, that is the light beings of the higher realms, lost the soma, they actually lost their connection to the interior bliss, to the direct experience of the divine within themselves, because that's really, I believe, what soma means in our lives. So having lost their soma, their let's call it their subtle Shakti. The gods were, of course, suffering as we do when we're out of touch with our connection to the bliss of the divine. And so they went to Vishnu, who is the deity whose cosmic function is to maintain the worlds and who is really the source of wisdom in the Hindu tradition in many ways. And they begged him for help. So Vishnu gave the gods a piece of advice that is very interestingly reminiscent of something that Carl Jung would have said. Vishnu directed the gods to form an alliance with their archenemies, the demons, who's the asuras. Asura in Sanskrit means anti-god. Sura is the name for god. Asura means anti-god. And the asuras, whom we call demons, though that name is a little bit misleading, were powerful, titanic, dark force energies, literally the embodiments of the dark side of the force. And they are also known as power gods. And in our psyche, of course, they represent the power shadow, the often unexpressed drives for dominance, aggression, our deep cravings, the will to power itself. Let's call it the Superman complex that, you know, exists inside humanity, the Promethean quality in humanity. These are, in fact, the forces of ego, but not only ordinary ego, you know, our normal ego, but actually the powerful forces that in Christian mysticism are sometimes called principalities and powers. In other words, not our normal dark side, but the drives that arise when the subtle spiritual ego begins to get in touch with some of the powers that come to us as our spiritual practice unfolds. So what Vishnu was saying is that to actually experience enlightened states, in order to experience the soma, there's an alchemical process that's required. And as many of you know, in alchemy, in the process of psychoalchemy, the so-called dark material, the power drives, the drives of aggression and selfish sexuality and all of the aspects of our human desire nature, jealousy, envy, all of those qualities that we often reject in ourselves, need to be joined to our higher qualities, our kindness, our generosity, our desire to align with the higher will. And in order to really allow the deep powers of awakening to come to full fruition, space has to be given to the dark qualities and to the light qualities. We have to learn how to, in a certain sense, hold space for both of them so that the dark qualities can be transmuted and we can really experience non-duality. And when that happens, it's not as though the dark qualities take over or that they disappear. It's that they are literally transmuted. So aggression becomes power, the power of activity. Lustfulness becomes the extraordinary, supra-sensual bliss of the awakened Shakti. Greediness becomes the desire for deeper experience and transmutes ultimately into the experience of oneness. But in order to transmute these qualities, we actually literally need to bring them into the light. So if you're a follower of Jung or a reader of Jung, you know what this means in psychological terms. And this is what the gods did. They got together, the light and the dark forces of the cosmos got together, each on one bank of the ocean of milk, and began to churn it the way in those days milk was churned to get butter. And if you remember what those churning vessels looked like, you know that there would be a pole in the center, called this churning stick, and attached to it would be rope. So the gods were holding one end of the rope, the demons were holding another, and the story goes that the great world mountain, the central pillar of the world, which is called Mount Meru, became their churning stick, and the great serpent, Asatia, the serpent who holds the worlds from the core of the earth, becomes the rope. And Meru is an arcane symbol for the central channel, the Sushumna Nadi, in the center of the spinal column, and the serpent is Kundalini. So the gods, of course, are our virtuous qualities, and the demons are our darker qualities. And as they churn the ocean of consciousness, magical gifts begin to arise, the gifts representing the extraordinary treasures that begin to come into our consciousness as Kundalini rises. And in our worldly life, the gifts might include wealth, opportunities, creative unfolding, all sorts of subtle abilities like the power to influence others or the power to understand esoteric teachings. Many forms of breakthroughs arise. Many unexpected gifts come to us as Kundalini flows through our body. One of them being the ability to have our wishes come true, our words come true, one of the more seductive gifts of Kundalini. And then at one point in this process, a poison rises from the ocean, a poison so intense that it actually threatened to destroy the world. The story goes that Shiva, who is the deity who in mythology represents the yogic process itself, Shiva is the deity of yoga, especially the internal yoga, the yoga of meditation, he seizes the poison. He takes the poison and he swallows it. And then at this moment, his consort, who in this myth is Kali, grabs his throat, places her hand around his throat to hold the poison in Shiva's throat. And at that moment, he becomes known as Nilakanta, blue-throated Shiva, because he literally holds the poisons of life, meaning the poisons of the psyche, suspended in his throat. And we're going to talk about what this means in the course of the class. So the world is saved, and at last, at the end of the process, the goddess Lakshmi rises from the ocean carrying a pot filled with the nectar. And the gods managed, I won't tell you the whole story, to trick the demons into giving them the pot to hold, at which point the gods quickly drank the nectar and the demons didn't get any. So what does this mean other than the fact that some of us who have a soft spot for the dark side feel that it was a little unfair that the demons did all the work and or did half the work and didn't get any of the nectar. But the symbolism here, given that the soma is the pure awareness and bliss that's the goal of our practice, that awareness bliss cannot be experienced by the ego. The paradox here is that the ego, the egoic drive, are always part of the motivation for practice. In other words, our tuning into spiritual practice is not only coming from a pure desire to know the divine. It's also coming from the desire to feel better, the desire for certain powers, abilities. This is just true of all human beings. And so often it's that personal striving for somehow improving ourselves that impels us to do a lot of the work in our practice. And I know for many of you, part of the spiritual process has been learning to move through your perfectionism, your fear of not doing it right, your feeling that you're not getting the fruits that you'd come to expect. All of these are part of the subtle spiritual ego. Everybody has them. And this spiritual process always involves experiencing these qualities, seeing them, and beginning to let them go and move beyond them. So one of the other aspects of the process, especially when Kundalini is awake, that there will be a period where the ego realizes that it has a new power, and that it then explores and experiments with the power of Kundalini. Some of us have experienced this for ourselves, and often it's quite innocent. You know, it's a kind of innocent playfulness. I know that at one point in my own journey, I discovered that I had become incredibly attractive and persuasive. In other words, people were drawn to me, were attracted to me. And because I had always had a secret desire to have people attracted to me, you know, to be popular and well-liked, I felt an enormous satisfaction in this. And then there was a moment when I realized that it actually wasn't me, the egoic Sally, so to speak, that was drawing people. It was the energy. It was the energy of Kundalini. And this experience of, you know, what one of my friends called social siddhis is so powerful, so prevalent that pretty much everyone experiences it at some point. And then the question is, as with all the gifts that come from Kundalini, are you going to spend a lot of time exploring that or exploring the healing power that comes to some of us, exploring the artistic gifts that come to some of us, and many of us do. There's nothing wrong with that. But at some point in the journey, we actually need to remember that our goal is to drink the nectar, not simply to enjoy the gifts, the other gifts that arise in the ocean of consciousness, but to really sip and take in the nectar of consciousness that is what she wants to give us. And at some point, we were back to the story of the demons. If the process is to complete itself, the ego just does have to dissolve. And the story tells us it's really about that nectar being sequestered from the ego. So, and it's, you know, normally this doesn't happen to us voluntarily. It's, you know, even though as sincere spiritual seekers, we may be going, oh, please take away my ego. Even that request to have the ego taken away is coming from ego. And that's one of the reasons why at some points in our journey we experience real setbacks or inner difficulties that put the ego's agenda in jeopardy. So here's the paradox that we're facing and working with in this journey. We have to enlist our entire structure, including our ego structure, both the light and the shadow sides of ourselves. It's very important to fully experience the shadow side, not just to try to, you know, kick it out, but in the process of transformation, nonetheless, in order to really absorb the nectar, we have to allow the egoic qualities, the dark force qualities, as well as our attachment to the light qualities, to be transformed, to be absorbed. And this is really what Ramakrishna means when he said to the goddess, take my sin and take my virtue. Actually, he said, take your sin and take your virtue. Give me only pure love for thee. Take your good and take your evil. Give me only pure love for thee. That's the recognition that arises as we sip the ocean of nectar. So, in this process, this experience of the poison arising out of the ocean of consciousness, of course, represents the tendencies, the negative emotions, the old memories, the difficulties, etc., that have been lodged inside our consciousness through our many lifetimes of struggle, of pain, of conditioning. They all show up and confront us. And the way we work with them is by allowing awareness. Shiva represents pure awareness, to see and hold through the grace of Shakti these tendencies so that they can literally be held in awareness and dissolved by the power of Shakti. And it's in this process, which is the churning, which in our meditation and breath practice, powered by Kundalini, we allow awareness powered by Shakti to digest the poisons, the tensions and blocks in our physical and subtle body. And that purification process, the release of, let's call them, the karmic tendencies, is going to happen for each of us in a uniquely individual way. One of the reasons why it's so hard to make rules for how Kundalini works is that it really is absolutely individual. In other words, your process and my process are alike in certain ways. I certainly recognize most of the experiences, the positive and the negative ones, so-called negative ones that people share. But they're also unique because our karmas are unique. And in many of the traditions where mystical experience isn't fully cataloged, there's not enough information about how the process works to allow people to really understand it when it happens. And it's also, since so many of the traditional texts about Kundalini describe her as she works in the lives of very dedicated yogis, people who really have very little karma, you know, someone like Ramana Maharshi or Ramakrishna or my guru, Swami Muktananda, had relatively little karma. They had little enough karma so that their self-realization process could happen in a relatively short time, certainly in a much shorter time than has been my own experience. But their very dramatic sadhanas sometimes only partially apply to us because our experience of Kundalini working to dissolve our karmas and open us to the blazing light of the inner self will happen more slowly, will take longer, because we are also working out our family lives, our desire lives, and the commitments that we've made perhaps through lifetimes to accomplish certain things in the physical world, in the material world. And at the same time, and I know that many of you know this, for many of us as Kundalini moves in our lives, we get a sense of our karma speeding up. So, you know, for instance, so many people say this, there's a tumultuous transformation in a relationship. A marriage ends and ends in a way that's quite dramatic. A physical disease arises and like heat and sudden fevers. Or you might simply feel a powerful urgency of anger or lust or, you know, be radically attracted to some completely unsuitable person. Many, many people in my classes and, you know, in my years of practice, I've seen this so often, will suddenly fall in love. And sometimes the falling in love is with somebody who either doesn't love them back or loves them back for a little while and then disappears. And what they will often discover later on is that this was a karmic relationship that was there in their field, in their sushumna, to be worked out, and that it just arose and was experienced very quickly, in 1 month instead of 10 years of marriage, or, you know, in whatever way it works out. What you notice, if it is a Kundalini purification, that when the event is done, you actually have an experience or an intimation that something has been lifted. A couple of years ago, in 2013, I had an experience that showed me how multi-layered the purification can be. I've been experiencing a very intense abdominal pain, which was localized in my right side, actually. And I did the spiritual practices that I have been taught to do with issues like this. I did acupuncture, I did homeopathy. I changed my diet, stopped eating nuts. And then I began to work with the emotions that surfaced around the pain. This is a pretty great practice, actually. You know, you feel into the physical pain and you just ask the discomfort, what is it that you want to show me about my emotional holding? I found out a lot about certain early childhood experiences that seemed to be held in that area. But when the pain didn't go away, I went to my doctor, and it turned out that it was actually appendicitis. And after I was rushed to the emergency room and the appendix was cut out, it turned out that there was a very rare malignant tumor in my appendix. It had been slowly growing there. And when the appendix was removed, that the cancer cells came with it, that it hadn't spread at all, thank God. But after the whole thing was over, after I had, you know, kind of recovered from the operation, I experienced a sense of the most incredible psychic freedom that, very hard to describe, but the difference between my experience of myself before that and after the operation was really very radically different. In other words, some big chunk of karma had been removed from my body with the appendix and probably the tumor. So my point is that as Kundalini works in your system, almost every event of your life can be, if you're willing to practice with it, becomes an occasion for this transformation. In other words, your karma, the events that you have to undergo in this life, instead of just being stuff you suffer through or, you know, stuff you enjoy while it's lasting, actually becomes a kind of magical occasion for your continuing freedom. And it's one of the reasons why life becomes so magical when Kundalini is awakened, but it's also really important that we understand it. Carl Jung wrote about an early case of his before he understood anything about this process. A woman who was having experiences of Kundalini rising in her body, and she was feeling bliss and spiritual insight, having some very strong dreams, as many of you have, some scary, some beautiful. Sudden physical symptoms like heat and sudden fevers would appear and disappear. And Jung knew nothing about Kundalini. He was trying to work with her as though she had a disease. And then several months into the process, he was given a copy of an important book about Kundalini called The Serpent Power, which was actually the first book published in a Western language that really unfolded the classical tantric lore on this topic. And of course, Kundalini works synchronistically, as Jung himself knew. In other words, it's both working in your internal world. It also manifests through events in the external world. So we could say that it was pretty much an act of Shakti's grace for Jung, you know, in this time, which was in the early part of the 20th century, when nobody in the West really knew about this kind of thing. He somehow managed to find the one book that could give him information in the middle of her treatment. So when he read the book, he saw what was happening to her, and he wrote later, "My whole treatment of this woman was a series of blunders. It showed me that a therapist should have a natural reserve that keeps him from riding roughshod over the mysteries that they do not understand and driving them flat." So that statement, of course, you know, really speaks to the necessity for understanding the process. And he came to understand something that we understand as well, that we work with Shakti not by trying to control her or change her, but by giving Kundalini the nourishment she needs through our breath meditation, through our diet, and by keeping company with those who are sympathetic with our spiritual aspiration, but above all, by loving the Shakti as she's arising and transforming us. So you can again be present with the breath. Be present with the Sushumna Nadi. Feel the inhalation rising through the crown, the exhalation drawing down from that region above the head, the awakening Shakti, Kundalini, allowing it to flow through your head and neck and chest and down through your body. Just imagining for this moment that it is the soma, the nectar, the liquid light that is the expression of Kundalini Shakti in her awakening form. The mantra Om Aim Hrim Shrim, drawing the breath upwards. The mantra Om Aim Hrim Shrim, activating that inner vibration of light and energy which flows down through the body to the base. For some of you, the sense of upward movement or downward movement may feel a little bit too focused. And if that's the case, just allow yourself to be present with the pulsation, the energy that Kundalini is expressing. In the texts on Kundalini, several forms of Kundalini action are described, and I want to say a few more of them as well. And I'm just telling them to you in a very short form, because some of you may recognize the way energy feels when it moves in your body. One of the forms of in which we experience Kundalini Shakti moving is what's called an ant-like movement, a kind of creeping sensation. This feeling is often focused in the base of the spine. Sometimes it's actually experienced as though ants were crawling up your spine or through your body. Another experience is of, it's called a frog-like movement, in which there's a sensation of throbbing, and many, many people have talked about this, just this experience of pulsation, sometimes in your spine, sometimes in other parts of your body. This is a very important way that we experience Kundalini moving. And one of the ways that we can meditate with her is by really just allowing our attention to focus on those parts of our body where there is pulsation or throbbing. Another and quite dramatic way in which we experience her is in what's called a serpent-like movement, a kind of a fiery feeling of heat that is often concentrated in the third chakra in the navel region. Another, and this is one of my experiences, is the sense of weightlessness or of expansion. It's the expansion of the prana, of the air element. There might be a sense of floating movement or sweeping movement. Often we experience that expansion in the region of the heart. And another is that there is just a wild feeling of, you know, a kind of leaping energy that may flow upwards or may flow downwards. And for most of us, there is a characteristic way in which Kundalini moves. And there are also many, many symptoms, let's call it, that the texts of contemporary Kundalini writing have described. Again, some of the psychological symptoms are a deep yearning for inner growth, feeling like you don't quite fit in. Sometimes feeling lonely. And I want to say from my own experience that when you do have that feeling of loneliness, one of the very skillful ways to practice with it is to just stay with the feeling. Hafiz, in one of his poems, says, don't try to run away from the feeling of loneliness. Let it cut deep. Because that experience of that heart feeling of loneliness can actually transform itself into the opening of the heart. Another symptom of Kundalini in the body is feeling just inwardly connected, in tune, fulfilled. And another that's very common, and I'm sure that many of you have experienced, is just simply feeling more sensitive and vulnerable than usual, feeling skinless in a certain way, even though there's no real reason for it. Having special capacities arise, heightened creativity, or some skill starting to show up. And of course, having mystical experiences, seeing lights, hearing inner sounds, having these experiences of expansion or energy moving in the body. The sense of existential restlessness is a very common feeling of, especially in initial Kundalini activation. Becoming sensitive to food you eat, to the people you're with, to the environment. Heightened intuition or insight or empathy. Having your spiritual practices bear fruit. Natural highs arising. Being interested in helping other people. Starting to question your own values. The desire to meditate, to pray, to read about holy people, to hang out with spiritual people. A feeling that something transformative or holy is happening, and I see that in almost everyone in this class. Glimpses of bliss, insight into the meaning of spiritual teachings. I have a friend who, shortly after his Kundalini became active, he's Puerto Rican, and he'd gone home to visit his mother. He was in the Catholic church that his family had always attended and receiving the Eucharist, and he suddenly got, not as a vision, but just as a recognition of how at the moment of the Eucharist there was a kind of vortex of transformational energy that came into the communion wafer, and that he actually could experience as a transmission of Shakti through the lineage energy of that tradition or perhaps of that church. So we understand a lot of things with the awakening of Kundalini without necessarily reading about them or hearing about them. When someone has had a very strong awakening, transformation happens pretty much spontaneously, and our job, and in fact it is in some ways the best, but the traditional way of working with Kundalini is just to let it happen, to surrender to the process and to gently nourish it by cultivating our ability to be the witness. And I know that there are several of you who are having intense Kundalini experiences and who've discovered that the best way to practice with them is just to let them happen and to witness them, to watch them, without worrying too much or thinking about what's happening. When the awakening process has been less intense, or when we have worldly responsibilities, family ties, and a lot of karmic baggage, which is the case with most of us, certainly, it's been my experience, then more is required of us. And this includes regular daily meditation, regular mantra practice, correct exercise, attention to diet, and I've offered you a Kundalini and diet handout that's available on the course homepage. And it's a pretty comprehensive explanation of what the tradition says about diet. And I have to say that it's been my experience that understanding what Kundalini likes in terms of diet is really, really helpful. And for many of us, some psychodynamic processes to help resolve psychological imbalances are not only helpful, but also also very, very charged by Shakti. So we're going to talk more specifically about some of the psychological aspects of the awakening in our next couple of classes. In this time, in the remaining period of this class, we are going to, as promised, begin to practice with the chakras. And this part of the class will be pretty much a meditation. We're going to be doing a kind of extended chakra meditation. And so you might want to just stand and stretch, or you're also welcome to lie down for this meditation as long as you keep your back straight. That said, if you lie down in Shavasana, it is actually, in the type of practice that we'll be doing, you actually can do it in a Shavasana, although, as most of you know, the practice is stronger when we're seated upright, because it really does allow the nadis, the energy channels along the spine, to be activated more easily. So in this particular journey through the chakras, we're going to be practicing with the breath and also with the elements in the chakras. So I'm going to describe briefly some of the ways in which they were seen by the sages in the tantric tradition. We'll also be tuning into the chakras in our own bodies. And I want to say, as we begin this, that the images of the chakras in the tantric texts are images that the sages of this tradition seem to have seen in their own meditation. And they describe them as having qualities of the subtle elements, as having qualities of particular deities, as having animal entities within them. I would say that for many of us, the best way to look at these expressions in the chakras is symbolically. In other words, it's not that they're not real. It's not that they're not experienceable in these forms. But at a deeper level, when we think of the chakras as really of these images of the chakras as meditation guides, as meditation, visual meditation aids, which have the power to activate the energies in the chakras through the visual meditation, it often allows us to have a more creative relationship with these centers than we would if we thought you're supposed to be seeing a ram in the third chakra or an elephant in the root chakra. The animals and the deities actually represent qualities that begin to be activated as the chakras begin to be opened. And I also want to say that these meditations are not about opening the chakras, though you may experience openings in your chakras. They are designed to deepen your immersion in the inner world by practicing visually and energetically with these centers. It's a really important distinction that I'd like to draw here, because even though many yogis and teachers, including myself, will offer practices, meditation practices or yoga practices or mantra practices that are aimed at awakening a particular chakra, the fact is the true opening of the chakras in the awakened Kundalini tradition actually happens spontaneously. So if someone tells you that your chakras are out of balance, one chakra is overactive, another chakra is underactive, it may have some relevance to your physical or psychological condition. And the practice that we'll be doing during this time and in the week to come is actually helpful in giving us a deeper relationship to some of the chakras. But the fact is, it's not really, how shall I say, it's not ultimately productive to try to use the mind and will, our personal will, to open the chakras. So our goal really is not so much to force them open or to coax them open or whatever, but really to allow ourselves to bring the mind and will more deeply into the subtle body. And the other thing I want to say is that the tradition gives the impression the journey through the chakras is linear. This is not, in fact, true. The different chakras can open at different times and in different ways. And another point that is important to understand is that when we're practicing with Kundalini as we are doing from the top down, so to speak, from imagining and feeling the energy flowing in through the crown and down to the base and then rising up with the exhalation, what will happen for many of us is a kind of activation of the Sahasrara, the topmost chakra. And you may experience, when you're practicing like this, purificatory experiences or subtle experiences that are related to the tendencies or the samskaras, as they're said, of you know, different chakras, the second or the third or the heart chakra. And yet you won't feel energy moving in that part of your body. In other words, the main sensation in the energetic body will be of energy in the crown or energy over the head. And one of the reasons for that is that the Sahasrara, the topmost center, actually contains the energies of all the chakras. And so as we activate the crown center through this kind of meditation, we are actually in what many of the sages feel is the safest and most natural way. We are opening the chakras by beginning to open the crown center. So let's begin to become aware of the breath moving in the body, the inhalation flowing in through the crown, flowing down through the body. And we'll start, as we have been for the last couple of weeks, by becoming present to the Muladhara chakra. The chakras, as you know, are vortexes of energy that are arranged along the central channel and which actually link the activities of the physical, subtle, and causal bodies. So the chakras are often described, the word chakra means wheel. So the chakras are sometimes described as spinning wheels of energies, and they are often, in Western understanding, considered to be related to particular organs and to connect the subtle energies to the physical world. And that's probably true, but the fact is that the chakras are in the subtle body, and though they may be connected to the physical body, the fundamental experience of the chakras is non-physical. So each chakra is pictured in on the home page. So you, if you have your computer open, you can turn to the home page, or you can look at the pictures later. The pictures that we're showing of the chakras come from a beautiful book by Harish Johari called Chakras. Has beautiful color illustrations, very elaborate illustrations of the different petals and the deities of each chakra. Each chakra has a center, which is called the bindu, or point, that contains the essence of the energy associated with that particular chakra. From this center emanates waves of subtle energies, which are shown as petals, like the petals of a flower. And in fact, sometimes we see the chakras as flowers. Each of the petals has a sound, a seed syllable associated with it. And according to the tantric tradition, each petal has certain qualities, certain tendencies, which in some of the chakras can be negative, but which, and again, this brings us back to the story of the ocean of milk, which as the chakra is activated through the rising kundalini, these negative tendencies, these binding tendencies, become liberated and they begin to open up the unique powers that are associated with each chakra. So as these chakras open, we have physical experiences, which may have to do with the organs. You have subtle experiences, which are activated through the mind and emotions. And you'll also have subtle experiences that we feel as higher, subtler energies or even visions. The classic way in which the chakra is activated is by chanting or working with the seed syllables that are associated with the element in each chakra, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to meditate on the element and on the sound. In the traditional cosmology of the chakras, each chakra is said to contain a deity, subtle force that actually governs and rules the energy in that chakra. In each, there are sometimes a couple of male deities, and in each of them, there is a form of the Hindu trinity of governing deities, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. There's also a deity who represents the element in the chakra. You know, that is, by element, I mean the subtle elements of earth, water, fire, air, and space. And there's a goddess who activates the chakra, who holds the particular type of shakti, the activating force of cosmic energy in that chakra. And as I say, on the student page, the course page, the pictures show all these. And there's an animal who represents the elemental aspects of the chakra. The whole constellation is in the form of a mandala, a geometric form, which is represented in triangles, squares, or circles, and often all of these. So we're going to bring our awareness up through the chakras, beginning with the Muladhara, which in our last two classes we have contemplated as being actually below the body, about 8 finger widths below the body. And you can, with the next exhalation, begin to bring your awareness down to the Muladhara. Inhaling up to the crown, and then exhaling and letting the awareness come down to the base of the posture, to this region just below the perineum. Knowing that the Muladhara is the seat of resting kundalini and of the primordial evolutionary energy of life. Its quality is earth. So it's connected with the element of earth and with the earthy qualities of strength from balance and support. The color of the traditional color associated with the Muladhara is yellow, which is the color of earth. But the Muladhara chakra has four red petals, which we've discussed already. And I've found it very interesting to study embryonic development in relationship to the Muladhara. Because, as you know, Kundalini in her resting form is coiled within the center of this chakra inside a downward-facing subtle triangle, which represents Shakti coming to earth. Inside of it is a pillar-shaped light, a phallic-shaped light called the Lingam, which is also called the Swayambhu or self-born Lingam, meaning the self-existent thrust of evolutionary energy. And in our physical development in the inseminated embryo, the yolk sac of the ovum develops into what's called the gut tube, which literally arises from this place that we experience as adults in the base of the torso in the embryo before there's even a body. So we could say that this is perhaps the physical manifestation of the self-born lingam. So with your awareness at the base of the posture, let's activate our relationship to the Muladhara chakra. The goddess of this chakra is called Dakini, and she holds the energy of creation. And of course, the Sushumna Nadi rises from within the Muladhara. So with the exhalation, gather your attention in this region below the spine and imagine the energy within this center, the energy below your body, as earth, as soil, as rock. And we're going to visualize the base of our body, and that means that below the body, but also the perineum, the base of the spine, the rectum, your legs, your feet, filled with earthiness, with soil, with rock, literally melting into the earthiness, the fleshiness, the solidity that is contained in the earth element. So your whole lower body, from the perineum, the rectum, the sexual organ itself, down through the thighs and knees and calves, are filled with earth. And now we're going to inhale and exhale inside the Muladhara chakra. And as you're feeling the earthiness, you can think to yourself the seed mantra of earth, which is Lang. It's spelled L-A-N-G or L-A-M. The A is short, so it's pronounced Lang. And if you want to chant it to yourself, the correct way to chant it is to make the mouth into a kind of a square shape. Touch the tongue to the palate, to the upper palate, the hard palate, and say the mantra somewhat nasally, Lang. And you, as you do that, you might feel the vibration of it, Lang. See if you can feel that vibration in the perineum and below. Lung, it has its own vibrational power. Lung, this is the resonance that in the tradition is said to actually manifest the earth element. Lung, you don't have to recite it, you can just think it. Feeling as you think it, that the sound syllable of Lung is resonating in this region of earth, and that as you sense it, you're feeling the incredible solidity, the groundedness of this part of your body. Now with the next inhalation, allow the breath to rise into the second chakra, the Swadhisthana, which is located just in front of the lumbar spine between the two protruding pelvic bones. So it's in the lower pelvis, 3 or 4 inches below the navel, in the very center of the body. So just allow the inhalation to draw your awareness upward to the Swadhisthana, the second chakra, which is the region of water, the element of water. Swadhisthana means own place, your own place. So as you inhale up into the second chakra, into this region in the lower pelvis, see if you can become present to the sense of oceanic flowing liquidity in this part of your body. The sound syllable of water and of the second chakra is wang, wang, V-A-M or V-A-N-G. And you make a circle of your mouth, and again allow the tongue to touch the top of the hard palate. Wang, and see if you can just sense that sound vibrating in this region in the lower pelvis. The deity of the second chakra is Vishnu, the sustaining energy of the universe, who is a healing deity. And this is one reason why healing the second chakra, opening the second chakra, awakens both your power of self-healing as well as your sexuality, your generativity. In the mythology, Vishnu sleeps, it's said, on the great ocean of consciousness, and this world is said to be his dream. So the water of the second chakra is literally the water of life. It's the water from which life forms emerge. And the elemental deity of the second chakra is Varuna, who is the god of the ocean and whose symbol is the half moon. So we'll meditate with the mantra Om Wang, thinking that mantra, or if you like, you can chant it, feeling it vibrating in the pelvic region, considering that the water here is the water of sexual fluid. It's the water that allows Shakti to lubricate your entire being with blissfulness. The goddess here is called Rakini Shakti. She's dark blue, and she's the goddess of taste. The Muladhara chakra is associated with smell, with fragrance. Second chakra is water and taste. The chakra has 6 petals. The animal of the second chakra is the Makara, which is a kind of crocodile, a huge amphibious sea creature who flows through the oceans and who has enormous power, just as a whale or a dolphin has this power, this mammalian flow inside the water element. And as you listen, see if you can sense the 6 petals in your pelvic center. Or even better, just feel as though your pelvis is filled with ocean, with the incredible flow of deep ocean out of which all life arises. When this chakra is unawakened, the 6 petals of the Swadhisthana are said to carry the qualities of neglect, insensitivity, credulity, suspicion, and cruelty. But as we meditate in the Swadhisthana chakra, as the chakra opens, and one of the best ways to open it or to allow it to open itself is simply through breath and the sensation of ocean. And the chakra dissolves egotism inside its waters. It actually allows us to develop deep emotional equanimity. And in my experience, to work with our emotional tendencies, it's very important to activate this chakra. When you feel the depths of the ocean inside the chakra. And if you like, you can actually imagine the breath flowing horizontally in and out of this region in the pelvis. And then with the next inhalation, allow your attention to rise up from the oceanic liquidity of the second chakra into the region just behind the navel, which is the region of the Manipura, the third chakra. Manipura means city of jewels. It's associated with fire and with the digestive tract. So if you can imagine a warmth, really a warmth, like a glowing coal or like a beautiful orangey red jewel in the region behind your navel, around the solar plexus towards the back of the body. And if you can allow the breath to flow in and out horizontally to this region, flowing in towards the back of the body, imagining a beautiful fire pit in the third chakra in which glows a beautiful orange-red fire. The seed syllable is arang, which is pronounced like the intoxicating drink, rung, and as you think it, see if you can feel its vibration in this region. The elemental deity of this chakra is Agni, the fire god, who is, of course, the deity who in all the ancient traditions is the one who carries offerings into the heart of life, to the higher regions, just as when we actually eat with a yogic awareness, we are making offerings to the fire of digestion. And this chakra is also associated with a form of Shiva called the Rudra, which is a name that literally means the howler, because he has this incredible howling war cry. And Rudra is a warrior deity whose energy, when awakened, deeply impacts our capacity to deal with our fears, and who has the power to destroy the negative elements in our body, as does fire. So in the unawakened third chakra, we experience fear. In the awakened third chakra, we experience courage, activity, the power of action. The goddess is called Lakini. The animal is the ram, the horned sheep. And the 10 petals of the Manipura, when they're unawakened or unbalanced, are associated with qualities like shame, treachery, jealousy, negative ambition, drowsiness, despondency, attachment to your possessions, delusion, aversion, and fear. So again, you can allow yourself to imagine the fire in the third chakra, feeling the breath flowing in and out of this center. As this center opens, as this chakra opens, we begin to experience qualities like deep happiness, the power to conquer difficulties, esoteric powers like being able to see into the essential nature of people, the ability to experience yourself centered in the present moment. And the deep stability that in the martial arts tradition of China and Japan comes from being centered here, because this is a place where Zen meditators focus, where martial artists focus, and it gives powerful centeredness. The fire in the belly. The sense associated with the third chakra is sight. And as you feel the warmth in the third chakra, you can inhale to the feeling, into the feeling of the anahata, the heart chakra, the fourth chakra, imagining it in the center of the chest, behind the sternum, towards the back of the heart. The heart chakra is actually very large. It's also the center of breath. And I think for many of you, it's very natural to feel the breath, the inhalation and the exhalation flowing in through the center of the chest, touching the back of the heart, the energy just in front of the spine and even behind the spine. Seed syllable of the heart chakra is yang, yang, which is the seed syllable of the element of air, prana itself. The anahata has 12 petals, which are deep red, and it's called anahata, which means unstruck, because it's the center where you actually can begin to hear the subtle sound, the unstruck sound that is variously described as soham or om. It's the midpoint between earth and heaven, and the symbol, the chakra symbol in the center is of the six-pointed star, which literally stands for the union of masculine and feminine, Shiva and Shakti, the upward pointing and downward pointing triangles, which come together in the heart for the first time. And in the very center of the star is a lingam, which is sometimes described as a thumb-sized flame. And it's also the seat of the anthropomorphic form of Goddess Kundalini, whom you can sense dancing with the breath as the inhalation flows into the heart and the exhalation flows through the heart, expanding the air of the heart like a subtle inner caress with the sound yang. The male deity here is Isha. He's a form of Shiva, who is literally means Shiva as the ruler. So the heart is the center of our command over the lower chakras, the animal elements. He sits on a black gazelle, which moves like the air. And the elemental deity is Vayu, who is also known as the Lord of Prana. And of course, as you know, as the heart center begins to open, we actually experience the subtle caress of the air, of the prana, of the breath in our heart, expanding the heart. So allow yourself to just feel into the heart center with the breath. perhaps even to imagine the presence of the thumb-sized light of the self, the Bana Lingam, as it's sometimes called, a flame about the size of a thumb. It's said that the individual soul rotates around the petals of the heart because in the Eastern traditions, the heart is said to be the seat of the mind, not the head, not the brain, but the heart. And of course, as we understand more and more about the physical heart, we also have come to realize that the heart is actually the seat of a very deep form of intelligence and is the magnetic center of the body. So much of what we are able to intuitively understand in the world comes through our centering in the heart, as contemporary scientific meditative traditions like HeartMath have brought into the corporate mainstream world. But according to the tantric text, when the heart is unawakened, when the chakra is unawakened, there's actually a mixture of qualities here, including expectation, deceitfulness, indecision, arrogance, rebelliousness, incompetence, regret, remorse. But the heart also contains longing, one of the most beautiful qualities of the heart. It contains the capacity for renunciation, for giving up what is unnecessary, and the discrimination that lets us experience the difference between what is true and what is actually unimportant. And it's in the heart center for many of us that our deep longing for awakening begins to occur. And as the heart center begins to open, there is very often this feeling that I mentioned earlier of loneliness. And that loneliness is partly the result of the wounds of love that we may have experienced in our lives. But as you sit with this feeling and just let it be there, what begins to happen is that awareness flows deeper and deeper, and you begin to open to this extraordinary feeling of pure being, of longing, of love and compassion and acceptance, which are the qualities of your awakened heart. So with your attention focusing on the heart, allowing the breath to flow in and out through the heart with the syllable yang, perhaps allowing the breath to kindle your awareness of the presence of this thumb-sized flame in the heart. And with the next inhalation, you can allow your attention to flow up from the heart into the area at the base of the throat, the region of the Vishuddha chakra, the fifth chakra, which is the region of subtle ether or space. And as we become aware of this region in the throat, for many of us, I'm having that experience myself at this moment, you may feel the tightness, the blocks in your throat, which is one of the symptoms of not only of the blocks in the fifth chakra, but also of what it feels like to have that chakra opening. And if you're feeling tightness in the throat, just swallow a couple of times. We're going to allow ourselves to breathe in and out of this center with the seed syllable hung. Hung, which is the seed of the element of space. So as you inhale and exhale through the fifth chakra, see if you can feel that your throat is filled with spaciousness, complete open spaciousness. As the awareness centers in the throat chakra, This is when you begin to experience the fact that your self, your being, is actually non-physical. You can begin to experience yourself as an energetic spaciousness, which may be experienced inside the physical body or around the physical body. In the pictures, the Vishuddha Chakra is pearly gray with 16 petals, and of course it's associated with expression and inspired speech. Much of the experience of purification in this center has to do with the throat. The Anahata Chakra and the Vishuddha Chakra, the heart center and the throat center, are almost one center. And as the heart opens, the throat opens. When the heart feels stifled, often there's a sense of a stifling in the voice. But as the center opens, we really do begin to experience much of the esoteric visioning and opening that occurs in dreams, as so many of you are having spiritual dreams. The chakra petals of the Vishuddha now are, once we reach the fifth chakra, there are no negative qualities. So inside the Vishuddha chakra are the notes of the Indian musical scale, which are said to come into the physical world from the subtle realms. They also contain both the poison that Shiva holds in his throat and the nectar that's dripping from the higher chakras. It carries the power of seven powers of inspired sacred speech, including, and this is something that several of you experience, including the power to use your voice to exorcise negativities, the power to lead ritual in such a way that everyone is carried into the ritual space, the power to speak your intentions and have them come true, the power to give blessings, the power to create exalted states in people you speak through. So as the Vishuddha Chakra opens, it unfolds the power of teachers, of priests, of sacred singers. It's the center of inspiration, of intuition, of higher creativity. And one of the great qualities of having the Vishuddha Chakra open is that you actually begin to recognize that you are fully worthy of receiving grace. We're going to do a whole class on this chakra. The deity here is called Ardhanarishwara. This is the form of Shiva that is half male and half female. It's the body of the united feminine and masculine energies. And when we begin to meditate in this chakra, we really do experience our attention rising into the subtle realms, into the subtle world. So allowing the awareness of the Vishuddha and the mantra HOM, let your attention now flow up into the center of the head, feeling that potential for infinite space rising through your throat, flowing up through the face and head until you come to the region of the Ajna Chakra, the sixth chakra, which is behind the region, behind the eyebrows, just above the upper palate, and you can touch the upper palate with the tip of your tongue, and then take your awareness above it to the very center of the head. It's a source of two flows of cranial nerves, one through the eyes and one through the midbrain. It's the crossing point of the three main nadis, the Ida, the Pingala, and the Sushumna. And of course, it's the seat of the wisdom eye, the third eye, the illuminated eye. Ajna means command. And it's here in the center that we actually receive the inner command that leads to full awakening. So it's also called the Guru Chakra. And for many of us, this seat of the Ajna Chakra is the place where our attention naturally flows in meditation. For some of us, it's the heart. But in the advanced tantric meditations of the Vijnana Bhairava, which we're practicing in our last class, many of the practices unite the heart with the Ajna Chakra. The mantra of the Ajna is Aum, and it's said in many of the tantric traditions that when we meditate in the Ajna Chakra, it actually develops the qualities of all the other chakras. So as we complete our meditation this evening, we're going to practice one of the classic tantric meditations. And we'll allow the energy to move, to flow between the heart and the Ajna. So with the inhalation and with the mantra, Om Aim Hrim Shrim, allow your awareness to flow in through the crown, to flow in as a stream of light through the crown, through this center just above the upper palate, down through the center of the throat to the heart. And with the exhalation, feel that the mantra carries your attention from the heart up to the sixth chakra in the center of the head. Just allow your awareness to flow in through the crown down to the heart with Om Aim Hrim Shrim up from the heart, expanding through the third eye center, through the Ajna. And little by little, begin to feel how the Sushumna Nadi, that subtle thread of awareness that runs through the body, actually flows easily from the Ajna down to the heart, from the heart to the Ajna. And see if you can allow the mantra Om Aim Hrim Shrim to flow with the inhalation down to the heart, with the exhalation up to the Ajna. Just let the mantra flow with the breath. Om Aim Hrim Shrim. Flowing in with the inhalation from above. Flowing out with the exhalation from the heart to the Ajna. And as you may have experienced, that sound actually activates the sixth chakra. So I'd like to suggest that you sit in meditation for as long as you feel comfortable, just letting the meditative flow carry you from the crown down to the heart and then back up to the ajna, expanding through the ajna. Om Aim Hrim Shrim, flowing with the breath. And this is a moment when you can experiment with the flow of the breath. Does it feel more powerful to inhale upward through the ajna chakra to the crown and then to exhale downward to the heart? Or does it feel more powerful to inhale downward from the crown through the ajna to the heart and exhale upward from the heart to the ajna? In opening the central channel, one of the most powerful ways to activate this channel is by really focusing on the connection between the ajna and the heart. As you intend to open the inner channel through this means, as you allow the mantra to flow with the breath, there is a gradual inward drawing of the attention. And in time, that channel opens and you begin to feel your awareness literally moving up and down the central channel. After a while, the thoughts begin to recede a bit. And you start to recognize that you're actually being breathed by the internal breath. You'll find on the student page the recent photos of the chakras, as well as some material on the chakra basics. It doesn't have the names of the deities, but we will arrange for those to be supplied as well. You'll be receiving a homework assignment tomorrow, and of course the audio will be available tomorrow for those of you who'd like to listen to this again. And those of you who are tuning in later on through the MP3, of course, you already have it. So as you practice now inhaling from the crown, I'm going to suggest this particular flow to the ajna, to the heart, back up through the ajna to the crown, allowing the mantra to flow with the breath. Having established a connection to the flow in the Sushumna Nadi, allow your next exhalation to bring your attention down through the central channel, just in front of the spine, down to the Muladhara Chakra. Feel the earthiness of that region of your body. Sense the water element in your pelvis, the fire in your belly, the air in the heart, the space within the throat, the subtle quality of consciousness in the sixth chakra. And see if you can let the flow of Shakti to come down from the higher regions with your exhalation, to flow up through the center of the body with the inhalation. See if you can feel your entire inner body awake and alive, grounded and expanded. Feel your belly, feel your feet, feel your heart. Feel the awareness that holds it all. Have an exquisite evening, day, week. I'll be answering your questions on the listserv, and next week we'll be having an extended Q&A. Thank you so much for being here. So much love. Namaste.